This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. During the stress-filled days of pandemic, millions are struggling with weird winter weather as well. Not you, Australia, where a record 50 degrees C, 122 Fahrenheit in December, was expected in Pilbara. For Northerners, we revisit predictions for this winter from expert forecaster Judah Cohen. Then an answer for supply chain problems, food inflation, and our sanity, we visit a special farm outside Kansas City where city mice learn how to grow their own food. But first, this timely song from America's troubadour, David Rovix.
The hospitals are full to overflowing, every hallway lined with hospital beds. No one seems to know quite where we're going, cemeteries overloaded with the dead. But my Wi-Fi is still working, I guess things could be worse. I'll be busking in the metaverse. You won't make someone sick out on the internet, at least not with a virus of that kind. You might be depressed or lonely, but as of yet, most likely you will find you won't have any need for a doctor or a nurse. Busking in the metaverse. There are famines going on in several countries, but not if you go dancing with the stars. On the internet, no one is hungry, or at least they have well-fed avatars. And they won't cross the street and clutch their purse when I'm busking in the metaverse. There are armies lining up along the borders. You can have your wars both cold and hot. Mercenaries following their orders. How much cryptocurrency you got? You can drop some in my case while I stand here and rehearse. Busking in the metaverse. Ice caps are all melting, forests are ablaze, toxic smoke blocking out the sun. So just put on your goggles, look at all the ways modern humans can have fun. It may be someone's salvation or a planetary curse, but I'll be busking in the metaverse. Busking in the metaverse. Busking in the metaverse.
This has been a difficult year for David, as for all of us. David performed his original songs in Copenhagen, the UK, all across America and Canada, everywhere. Now he must sing without the faces, trying to make a living in cyberspace. We are all buskers in the metaverse now. Find David Rovix at davidrovix.com. In the new year, we will investigate winter heat waves. But outside my studio on the West Coast, it is bitterly cold outside. There have been cold waves in Russia and Eastern Europe, with more predicted for Northern Europe. We return to weird weather and the question, how can we get extreme cold events when the world is supposed to be warming? This interview is Prediction and Explanation from Radio EcoShock, September 15, 2021. In 2018, I asked, if the planet is warming, why this awful winter weather? In February 2021, a wild cold snap crippled people and power right down to Texas. Will it happen again next winter? Our guest, Dr. Judah Cohen, thinks he knows why brutal winter storms are possible in the Northern Hemisphere, even though winters and the world are supposed to be warming. Judah Cohen is the director of seasonal forecasting at AER, which is the private company Atmospheric and Environmental Research. Cohen is also a research affiliate at the Parsons Lab at MIT, and he's the author of many scientific papers. I've been following his work for some years. He's been on Radio EcoShock a couple of times previously. So now, Judah Cohen and his colleagues have published their most definitive statement yet on the ways a warming Arctic can bring cold outbreaks to parts of the Northern Hemisphere. And the paper's titled Linking Arctic Variability and Change with Extreme Winter Weather in the United States. It was published in the journal Science in September 2021. From New England, Judah Cohen, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
A pleasure to be here. Thanks, Alex.
So, Judah, you have some recent tweets out with the first signals about possibilities for this coming winter. What are the signs?
Yeah, I mean, I just want to preface by saying it's very early. I'm more of a teasing, you know, trying to tease with the tweets more than give any kind of forecast. But as you know, as we show in the paper, there's a natural or standing wave across the Eurasian continent. So you have the ridge or the crest of the wave across northwest Eurasia with the trough of the wave across northeast Asia. And anytime that wave becomes amplified or greater in magnitude, that then favors disruption to the polar vortex and these cold air outbreaks like we saw last February in Texas. And the models have been suggesting that towards the end of September, maybe even into later fall months, that kind of pattern that we identified in the papers being favorable for these cold air outbreaks might be setting up. So I've just been teasing, and certainly if that pattern continues, then I think the risk cold air outbreaks will increase. But I mean, we're a long ways from there. Right? I mean, obviously, September, you know, many things can change, and more of a teasing mode, trying to get people's attention, you know, turning away from summer.
It was phenomenal what happened all the way down to Texas. It was the whole south, really, in the Central Plains, but the power system broke down and stayed down for some time. It was very expensive. As you point out in your new paper, it can be more expensive than hurricanes.
Definitely. We know for sure that it was the most expensive winter weather event, I think, in history, certainly the U.S., but probably, you know, globally. And actually, it may turn out to be the most expensive natural disaster or you know, weather disaster in Texas's history, which is better known for hurricanes, maybe droughts, certainly flooding as well. And yet, things we don't associate Texas with, you know, extreme cold and snow, it may turn out to be the most expensive natural disaster in their history.
And you work on signs and signals way up in the atmosphere, in the stratosphere, so that's above 12 kilometers or about 7.5 miles. I know it differs at the poles and the equator, but say roughly, it gives people a picture. And I know I've asked you this before. Listeners always want to know, if all the weather we experience develops in the lower layer, the troposphere below that, a sort of a thin layer, how and why do changes in the stratosphere manage to affect the weather below?
That's a great question. Most of the mass, I'd say about 90% of the mass of the atmosphere actually exists in the troposphere, and only 10% maybe above that, and you know, a good fraction of that is in the stratosphere, not all of it. So it is a kind of analogous to the tail wagging the dog to say that the stratosphere is influencing our weather. And with the most common or best studied polar vortex disruption, which we refer to as sudden stratospheric warming, is because there's very dramatic warming over the polar stratosphere, over the Arctic and the stratosphere. We don't really know or understand how that signal gets from the polar vortex to the troposphere and then it impacts the weather. It takes about 2 weeks. So I think really one nice result of our paper is that we really show that that signal originates here in the troposphere, you know, where all the weather is, where the jet stream is. And the polar vortex is just acting as some kind of medium for transferring that signal from Eurasia to North America. So actually the signal, I thought I described about the wave, so if the wave gets stronger, it gives off more energy. And what happens is that energy then boomerangs, so it goes. So energy in the atmosphere doesn't only just propagate or you know move horizontally, but it moves vertically. You know, like a sound wave would move in all directions, so the same thing. So the energy kind of, so the Eurasian wave gets energized and it gives off more energy, and that energy then goes up towards the stratosphere and actually boomerangs or bounces off the polar vortex and then goes down towards North America. So I think it's, you know, it's much more easier for us to understand and physically that's, we could follow the signal from start to finish, which doesn't exist with the this other much more studied polar vortex disruption, and this is open question how exactly it influences our weather.
Well, right. Let's dig into some of the science behind this new winter weather forecasting. Scientists have discovered new disruptive activities in the stratosphere, and one of them, and people were intrigued and alarmed to hear about this, it's called sudden stratospheric warming. They sound like powerful events, and maybe they're similar to what we worry may happen here on the surface, some kind of sudden warming. What is sudden stratospheric warming, and why does it matter to weather forecasting?
You know, it's very dramatic. So something will happen in the – there's this warming that happens in the polar stratosphere that we actually won't see in the troposphere. Like at the pole, the temperatures can warm by more than 70 degrees Celsius or over 100 degrees Fahrenheit in just a matter of days. So, I mean, you know, we would not see that, you know, at the surface. So it's much more dramatic than anything we see with our weather. But with that warming, the atmosphere has to kind of balance itself out. So a lot of the pressure has to balance that warming. So typically over the Arctic, both in the troposphere and the stratosphere, you tend to have cold, low pressure. When you get these sudden stratospheric warmings, not only does you get this dramatic warming, but also you get a very inflating of the pressure. So you get much higher pressure over the Arctic, and that's because warm air is lighter than cold air. So it's maybe a little complicated. I don't want to get too complicated with it, but just like cold air, it's much denser, so the pressure levels condense. We just refer to that as low pressure. It's really lower in altitude. And then the warmer air is lighter, so the atmospheric layers kind of bulge out, dilate upwards, so you get high pressure because they increase in altitude. It's higher altitude. So you get warm air over the Arctic with high pressure. And that tends to move around the polar vortex, we have a jet. It's not the jet stream, but it's a jet. So it's a fast-moving ribbon of air, similar to our jet stream, but it's not exactly the same. And that tends to move towards the equator, and that allows cold air to go much lower latitudes. And so that what happens in the polar vortex, about 2 weeks later, again, for reasons we don't fully understand, but we do observe it, 2 weeks later, it kind of replicates or mimics what happened in the stratosphere. So you get warm high pressure over the Arctic, so you can get these also very sudden, you know, kind of warming of temperatures. Maybe if it's normal temperature in the Arctic is, you know, minus 30 degrees C or something close to that, it can even get close to the freezing point. You have, you know, against that high pressure, and then the jet stream moves equatorward, and that allows colder air that's typically over the Arctic to move to much lower latitudes, and you get these Arctic or cold air outbreaks, which we're familiar with both in Canada and the U.S. So that's why these sudden stratospheric warmings are important for our weather.
So your new paper says sudden stratospheric warming events are actually decreasing since 1990. But a different, a more subtle kind of disturbance in the upper atmosphere is increasing. Please explain what stretching of the stratospheric polar vortex is.
Yes, yeah, so I just want to correct one thing. We didn't show that the sun stratospheric warmings are decreasing. We just showed that the stretched polar vortex events are increasing even more rapidly than the sun stratospheric warmings.
Okay.
And the other thing that's very important is that sudden stratospheric warmings are related or associated with extreme cold in Eurasia, where the stretched polar vortex events are more closely related or associated with extreme cold in North America. So that's another important thing. So, yeah, so we showed that in general, so I'll group them, sudden stratospheric warmings and the stretched polar vortex are kind of a weakening or disruption of the polar vortex, and those are happening more frequently. And the strong kind of modes or phases of the polar vortex are decreasing. So there's kind of this compensation from strong polar vortex to weak polar vortex. And we know we get an increase in extreme winter weather at in the mid-latitudes when we have either disruption of the polar vortex, though, you know, which continent is favored, you know, depends which disruption you get. So the stretched polar vortex, as I was trying to explain earlier, so this energy leaves the Eurasian continent. This naturally occurring wave, of course, Eurasia becomes greater in magnitude or is amplified. It gives off more energy, and that energy then moves both horizontally and vertically, and that vertical component then will kind of bounce off of the polar vortex, some of that energy actually, a little bit, gets absorbed into the polar vortex, and that's what actually causes it to stretch. So that's why we kind of refer to it as a stretch polar vortex. But most of the energy then boomerangs or bounces off the polar vortex and heads back into the troposphere. And again, there's this kind of natural wave that occurs across Eurasia with the ridge across the crest of the wave across the western part of the continent, you know, so near Alaska, and then troughing, you know, east of the Rockies, that trough of the wave. And that energy gets absorbed and kind of supercharges that wave. It becomes much greater in magnitude and in amplitude. It becomes of greater extent spatially, so that this more vigorous exchange of air masses, so warm air that's in the subtropics, let's say, gets transported towards the Arctic, typically towards Alaska. So there's a pretty significant warming of Alaska during many of these events. And then the cold air that's typically over the Arctic, over Alaska, let's say, northwest Canada, gets displaced southward and heads south, east of the Rockies. And, you know, so last February was a great example of that. That cold air built up in Canada, you know, brought record cold temperatures to the plains of Canada, the Canadian plains, and then it entered the northern plains of the U.S. and went all the way south. It was a bit of an unusual event that it went so far south like that, but, you know.
Yeah, okay. So in the paper you ask, and I quote, could climate change have contributed to the observed increasing trends in the stratospheric polar vortex stretching events that force cold to extreme cold in North America and East Asia? What did you find?
Yeah, we try to argue that yes, it contributed. It made the Texas cold wave more likely. I'm not going to say it wouldn't have happened without Arctic change. These events, this is not a new phenomenon. We're not arguing that this is something that didn't exist before. It always existed. It's just been over the satellite era, when we could sense or, you know, observe everything that's going on in the atmosphere, both the troposphere and stratosphere. So that satellite period, it has been increasing. It's almost doubled in number. You know, we're not saying that's going to just extrapolate that out forever, but there's certainly been a very noticeable increase. And we had both an observational or empirical analysis component. We did multiple types of analysis, and it certainly linked this increasing, you know, number of these stretch polar vortex events, so this increasing frequency, with Arctic change. And we also had a numerical modeling component to the study where we initialized a model with the trends that we're observing in with the changes in Arctic sea ice and snow cover across Siberia. And it also, when the model was initialized or forced with those Arctic trends, it also gave an increased number of these stretch polar vortex events. So very nice consistency we found between our observational empirical analysis and our modeling experiments. So we felt very confident that, you know, there was a connection between the two.
Well, you're a guy who really pays attention to snow cover over in what we would call Russia, whereas a lot of scientists and the public have really been looking at sea ice cover and the lack of sea ice as a sign of global warming. Why is the snow cover important, and is it decreasing or increasing?
Much of my early career was focused on studying the relationship between Siberian snow cover in the fall and winter weather in North America. But then the sea ice and the changes in the sea ice and maybe its impact on our weather got a lot more attention. It became a much bigger area of focus or concentration than the snow cover was getting. So, I mean, my attitude then was, at first I saw them as my competition, but then I figured can't beat them, join them. So I started also looking at sea ice. And I think they're, you know, two sides maybe of the same coin. It's all part of, you know, this more comprehensive Arctic change. So snow cover is decreasing in the spring and summer, and that was expected, and I think that's what people would, you know, are most familiar with. What is surprising and lesser known is that snow cover is actually, or snowfall is increasing in the fall season, the autumn season, across both continents. Actually, last year, North America had, you know, record snow cover extent, I think for the October and close to it for the whole fall season. So That was not something the models anticipated, projected. In the winter, you know, I think maybe there's a close to normal, you know, hasn't been much of a change, but certainly a very noticeable increasing trend in the fall. And I've tried to argue that could have, you know, important implication for our weather, because more snow cover across Siberia in the fall favors an increased number of polar vortex disruptions. Before this study, I really thought, okay, those polar vortex disruptions were really the sudden stratospheric warmings. I mean, this study, we showed, it can, you know, can be, but actually snow cover is more likely to force a stretch polar vortex, which was, you know, the focus of our study, more so than even a sudden stratospheric warming. So that was kind of you know, something I had been studying for more than two decades, and it was, you know, you think you can't teach an old dog new tricks, and it was really something new that I had realized with the study. But it, you know, answered some questions, lingering questions I had in the back of mind, like I just didn't understand.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is scientist and professional weather forecaster Judah Cohen. We're looking ahead to winter and why extreme cold can happen even during global warming. So let's go a little bit more global here. I know that your paper focuses on the U.S. Northeast, but will swings of the polar vortex cause similar cold bouts in other parts of the Northern Hemisphere? Where and where not?
We do know that disruptions of the polar vortex, or the polar vortex weakens, there's an increase in cold air outbreaks across the Northern Hemisphere. So, as I've been discussing, there are two types of polar vortex disruptions or weakenings. The one that's better, is most well known and more studied, is the sudden stratospheric warming. Those are associated or related with extreme cold across northern Eurasia, so both northern Asia and northern Europe. And we did show in a previous paper that those are increasing as well. And the type that we really focus on in this new study is the stretch polar vortex. So that favors cold air outbreaks, or, you know, is related to cold air outbreaks both in Canada and the U.S. east of the Rockies, and it is also related or associated with cold air outbreaks into East Asia. In the paper, we did also show that leading up to the event, northern Europe can turn colder as well. That signal wasn't as strong or as robust as for, let's say, Asia and eastern North America, but I think for Europe, most of the really cold air events most often associated with these sudden stratospheric warmings.
And I see you cite in your paper that Chinese scholars published their research fairly recently on the relationships between Arctic warming and extra cold in northern China. How does that relate to your findings?
You know, last year we had, you know, that Texas outbreak. It was kind of like in the second to third week of February. So, and it really kind of climaxed that like right around the middle of the month, February 14th or so. And China had also record cold right at the beginning of the month, around February 1st, I think the coldest temperature recorded in like 50 years or more. So that's consistent with what we find. So again, the first thing that happens kind of in this dominoes of, you know, of different steps or, you know, dynamical steps or pathways is that the Eurasian wave becomes more amplified, so it becomes greater in spatial extent. So that brings cold air down over East Asia, over China. So that was the first step. And then the energy boomerangs off the polar vortex and then amplifies or supercharges the North American wave about 2 weeks later. So what happened last year with extreme cold in China right around the 1st of February and then the extreme cold in the U.S. mid-month, you know, is very consistent with what we showed, you know, in the paper.
You're part of a stream of scientists working on this Arctic warming, colder winter relationship, including also people like Jennifer Francis and Dr. Overland. But the theory has met resistance from others like Mark Cerise at the Snow and Ice Data Center. Has there been movement towards your findings and the tech that you are developing?
I think many of the scientists, I think, that have been skeptical, kind of bit, you know, oh, I don't want to, maybe incalcitrant, it's too strong of a warm word, but you know, it certainly seems like people have dug into their, you know, respective camps. You're very skeptical that Arctic change can force colder weather in the mid-latitudes, or if you believe it, that is the case. And I don't know how many people that, you know, maybe convinced to change their mind, but I do think, you know, certainly the media, I think, has, I don't know, the word enamored is the right word, but, you know, certainly, you know, they've taken an interest to it. And there have been, you know, quite a few articles, you know, usually there are quite a few articles when you get extreme winter weather events, such as the Texas cold wave. I think the public, you know, has also maybe embraced it quite a bit. And I think young scientists, you know, maybe who didn't think about this, maybe, you know, when they're young and maybe more open to different ideas, sometimes kind of iconoclastic ideas. I think they have many more of these young scientists, you know, have come to think about this problem and, you know, maybe are certainly at least interested in pursuing it through their own study. So, you know, I think that's something that we've seen over the past decade or so. And I think a lot of the resistance comes to it because it is counterintuitive. If you're warming the globe, you're especially rapidly warming the Arctic, why should that lead, you know, the coldest place in the Northern Hemisphere, why should that lead to colder temperatures in places that are much warmer than the Arctic? I mean, I understand the resistance or hesitancy to the idea, but, you know, all the research that I've done now for over two decades leads me to believe that that actually is the case.
So are we at the point, Judah Cohen, where we can predict cold excursions during Northern Hemisphere winters and where they're likely to hit? And if so, how far in advance, how much warning can we give with this system of monitoring changes in the stratosphere?
Certainly if we see a sudden stratospheric warming, we know to expect. This is certainly an increased risk of extreme winter weather. Most of the research thought it could be anywhere in the northern, well, not anywhere in the northern hemisphere, but eastern North America, northern Europe, northern Asia. I think some of the studies that I've been involved with, including this study, really shows that it's more focused in northern Europe and northern Asia. And then our study shows that when you have a stretched polar vortex, again, there's an increased risk of cold air outbreaks across the whole northern hemisphere, but more focused in East Asia and eastern Canada, the eastern U.S. That helps us, you know, maybe prepare, because if you see sudden stratospheric warming, you know that the higher risk is across northern Europe, northern Asia. If you see a stretched polar vortex happening, then you know the higher risk is Canada than the U.S. I'm going to date myself with this thing, but you know, I think the stretched polar vortex was kind of, it was like the Rodney Dangerfield, you know, of polar vortex disruptions. It really didn't get the recognition and respect I think it deserves, because it can have a really big impact on our weather. So I'm hoping now that people look at it and say, oh, wow, this can have a big impact. It could lead to these. And, you know, and the Texas cold wave was certainly not the only really extreme winter weather. There are many that we just didn't realize was connected to these stretched polar vortex events. So, you know, if we could recognize it, the models can maybe predict the weather up to 2 weeks in advance. Obviously, that second week, the accuracy of those forecasts really drop off. You know, they kind of degenerate. Kind of, again, if we could see that amplification or this growing in magnitude and extent of the, and if we know what the polar vortex is favorable for, you know, kind of reflecting or acting like where that energy can bounce off the polar vortex, then I think we can get maybe 2 to 3 weeks lead time, at least say, hey, the conditions are favorable for one of these events, so let's, you know, raise the awareness. Yeah, obviously, I still think it would be hard to predict every one of these events and know exactly where the focus of the impact will be, but at least we can start looking at and monitoring, you know, maybe just like we might do with a hurricane, you know, in the development region, you know, the North Atlantic, off Africa. Of course, we don't know where that tropical wave or, you know, which will maybe turn into a hurricane, where it may end up, but we at least know we start monitoring. So maybe something analogous to that. At least I think we could, you know, raise in advance the monitoring, you know, that we need to be on guard and to follow and see how it plays out.
Well, I know you have scientific interest in figuring out how this works, but also you work for this company, Atmospheric and Environmental Research, and no doubt they have governments and corporate clients who will pay to know if these events are coming. Who will use this new forecasting tech as it develops further?
I mean, the people that certainly, I think, traditionally been most interested, you know, in these extreme winter weather events have been natural gas traders, because when you get these cold air outbreaks, you get a spike in gas prices. And, you know, the same would go even for utilities. I mean, obviously they have ranges, but I mean, I myself have been surprised by the different organizations and sectors that are interested. Certainly wildlife, let's say in Florida, if they get these cold air outbreaks, you know, it affects the wildlife down there, the manatees and the iguanas that famously fall out of the trees. I mean, there's not that much agriculture. I think these events can have, especially as you get towards that transition from winter to spring, I mean, it certainly can impact the agriculture as well. And, you know, people, public works departments are very much interested in these forecasts because if there's a snowstorm, obviously they need to be prepared with the machines and the salt.
Yeah, for a long time we've been told to expect warmer winters based on the climate models, and I'm wondering maybe municipalities will not replace as many snowplows or maybe companies won't spend on cold resistance for their power systems if they think that's what's going to happen. What does your work tell them?
You know, one of the more important takeaways from the study was if you're, you know, in, you know, a decision maker in public works, you know, you work for local governments and you're saying, well, I don't need to put as much resources in, you know, towards resiliency or, you know, preparing for extreme winter weather because the globe is warming and that's just going to, you know, so it's going to be milder winters, less snow. I don't need to put the resources towards that. It says, you know, it may not be, you know, that extreme winter weather may not disappear as quickly as you anticipate, and you should still, you know, at least in the near future, still need to prepare for it. And, you know, and so like Texas didn't really build up the resiliency to extreme winter weather, and they certainly paid the price last winter. And our paper says that, you know, that maybe, you know, even a place like Texas still may need to, you know, be prepared for extreme winter weather events. You know, have some kind of contingency plans in place when you get even, you know, like an historical event. You know, I mean, I think it's very complicated how climate change is impacting winter weather, but it's not as simple as it, you know, the globe is warming and so winters are going to get milder and there's going to be less snow. That Arctic change is also leading to these more polar vortex disruptions, which can favor these more extreme events. And it's really what we're observing is the combination of those two factors.
Well, I predict it's going to take some time for the public to realize as they're digging out from this record snowfall somewhere in the Northeast that, yeah, this is part of, you know, Arctic warming and global warming. It's going to take a while for people to realize, like you say, it's counterintuitive.
Yeah, and certainly, you know, people have used cold, you know, extreme weather, winter weather events to say, oh, well, you know, there's no global warming. How can it be so cold? How can we get so much snow if there's global warming and there's climate change happening? So our paper says, you know, there's a physical connection. It may not be intuitive, but we can show why they're consistent with each other and not one is not doesn't refute the other. You know, a heavy, big snowstorm doesn't mean there's no climate change, no global warming, but they can be consistent with each other.
We've been speaking with Dr. Judah Cohen, professional long-range weather forecaster for the company AER, and you can find links to the science we talked about and Judah's updates on large-scale weather trends in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Judah, thank you for keeping us ahead in this science.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I was happy to be able to join you again.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio. For the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. That was from Radio EcoShock, September 2021. Judah Cohen's prediction appears to be holding up very well so far this winter. But remember, weather is destabilized toward the extremes. We might expect a winter heat wave, too. Over the years, I've done many programs supporting local food and relearning how to do it. We're about to hear a great model from a community farm school near Kansas City. This comes from Eco Radio KC, as broadcast on KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. We will hear selections from the one-hour program. Get the whole thing from my show blog at ecoshock.org or Eco Radio KC on Facebook.
Community Voices is a production of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It is our way of letting the voices of our neighbors be heard.
This is Brent Ragsdale with Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Today we are doing an audio tour of KC Farm School. So I am sitting here in the KC Farm School office with Alicia and Ari.
Yeah. So, hi. It's so nice to have you.
And I've been wanting to do this, but today was a little bit of an extra stressor because they had some damage by the windstorm. So, yeah, Alicia, talk about that. What damage did you sustain?
We lost the west bay of the greenhouse roof. Winds blew it off at about 3 o'clock on Wednesday afternoon, and we spent the next hours deciding what to do with it. I mean, there's a lot of considerations. We're right by the highway. We were worried about it blowing off and hitting some cars on the highway. Finally, we secured it enough for the night because it just wasn't safe to be inside, to be outside or inside the greenhouse during that time. So we secured it, and since then, we're moving forward and putting a new roof on.
Our farm family showing up in different ways, whether that be volunteering, donations, like Alicia had said. So in times of this sort of like weird crisis, right, it's always a testament to the community that they show up. So yeah. We are very fortunate. And then I came back over the summer because they wanted to teach again and got to teach 9 to 14-year-olds here for our junior growers programming.
Tell us about that program. You were talking about the junior growers program.
Yeah. So junior growers is just one part or one aspect of the whole lens of this farm. So people ask, like, well, what age do you start? I mean, right now we have a 9-month-old on the field right now, like, touring and falling down into the soil and having fun. It starts at, you know, 0 to 180, however old you get, right? We offer programming for it all. So in structural terms, we have Ag Explorers, which starts at age 4. And then we have junior growers, and we are developing a new program for an ag apprenticeship program. So we can keep those that kind of grow out of junior growers ages, which is 9 to 14, that still want to be involved on the farm, and then maybe pursue it as a career. So from 15 to 18, really invest in learning on the farm and being a little bit more dedicated. We have adult workshops, and we have Let's Grow Wyandotte. And so it's something for everyone. We don't want to just open the front door. We want to open all the windows for people to have access here to learn and to engage in whatever capacity. So, yeah, we teach, but we also have volunteer opportunities that you can learn from. And we learn so much even from our volunteers.
We see the farm as the center of the community. That's our vision. And so it's a place where interdisciplinary, multi-generational, diverse, participatory food projects happen.
So the Junior Growers Program, is there are multiple sessions throughout the summer? Is that right?
Yeah,
or is
so
it the same kids all summer long?
Well, it's funny that you ask that, because we do have the same kids all summer long because they re-register weekly.
They love it.
They love it, and that's what's really sweet. So as you know, we're we're 3 years into this, and you know, to open the farm up to the community in the midst of a pandemic, wild. And so this last summer was the first summer to truly roll out the junior growers programming to age 9 to 14, and have them register for week-long sessions. They start on that Monday, not knowing each other, being a little bit uncomfortable. And then by Friday, they own the farm. They know where all the tools are. They've, like, planted something that they can come back even 6 months and go, oh, I planted that. Or they can harvest it, right? What we found was within the first two week-long sessions, we ended up having a wait list for the remainder of the summer because the students wanted to come back. And they were, you know, re-registering and re-enrolling. And it was incredible to have returning students with new students. It didn't spoil the fun. There were no spoiler alerts because, as you know, on a farm, your curriculum's going to change from week to week, month to month.
Sure.
You know, tomato season to, you know, whatever. It's going to change. So it was really exciting.
And then the program for the younger kids is also for families?
Yeah, Ag Explorers. Yeah, we want everyone involved. We want all ages. This last year has been really involved, really engaged, ages 4 to 8. It's amazing to see the parents be amazed by their children and the capacity of curiosity and dexterity that their children have that they might not be able to witness otherwise. Their kids have been indoors for the last 2 years. Now they're on a farm and they're doing things. And these parents, I think, as amazed as we are with the kids, we already know that they have that capacity. But sometimes the parents don't. They're like, oh my gosh, my child is building this. My child, you know, it's incredible to kind of re-see the ability of your child in real time.
And we've done it long enough that have we seen that some kids have really taken to farming and are trying to, you know, think about a career in this?
Yeah,
or it's impacting the classes that they're taking?
Well, I think the irony is, I mean, it's not ironic, but the sort of tech savvy kid, right? Mm-hmm. I say that very loosely, but they're indoors playing video games all day. Mm-hmm. And I think the irony part of it is we had in the summer, we had a lot of students that were into like games like Minecraft, right? And they're building digital gardens. You know, and then they come here and they're like, I can only be at home, you know, on Minecraft. I'm like, this is Minecraft in IRL, right? and to have them pull away, pan out and go, oh my gosh, it is. And their parents saying, my kid isn't on the, you know, doing the screens as much this week. And I think that's why we had re-enrollment, really, is because the students were unplugging, getting dirty, and feeling gratified from that. Right.
Oh, that's great.
So we had students that were tech savvy, that were video game like enthusiasts. You can do all the things, all right? You can do all the things, right? And be passionate about all the things. But once you go through the program, you go, oh, maybe I could be a farmer. Maybe what does that actually look like? And then to also see young farmers here working through the different programming that we have. Right, so they get to ask some questions and see them actually go, I'm choosing this as a profession. Right, that's unlike any of the experiences that I think we had growing up. At least I can speak for myself. I never got to talk to a farmer, especially a farmer that's like in their early 20s. What? Wild. Not too far from me, right?
Yeah.
So it's amazing to see them be curious, even if they don't end up farmers. To have that curiosity and regard and esteem for the farming community.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Eco Radio KC. We're talking with people from KC Farm School today. That was Ari Fish, who's the director of
education outreach, and I whisper marketing.
And marketing as well.
Go team!
So we'll be back and talk with Alicia and the rest of the team after a bit. Welcome back. Our topic today is the KC Farm School at Gibbs Road, and our next guest will not be a stranger to Eco Radio. It's none other than Dave Bennett Freeling. Dave,
how's everybody doing?
So we're going to talk about the sustainability plan that we've come up with and some other topics. So first off, tell us about this Eco Team for KC Farm School.
When we started creating the different programs at the farm school, we definitely, everybody involved seemed to have an interest protecting the ecosystem here and teaching people ways to do things that are going to be more beneficial for the environment, because we know that we depend on that globally, but definitely locally on the farm, very, very locally here in this space, here in this land. And so then we got together people to start to talk about what initiatives we would want to take on first. So we've all along, you know, been interested in energy and water. Clearly, it's really important. And then how we treat the plants and everything from the other resources that come on the land and the people. That's kind of where we started. And then we thought, well, let's create a plan that says here are the different steps we want to take to get there, and here are kind of some of the status of where we're at and where we want to go here on this land.
So during COVID, when we weren't able to physically meet, we were doing a lot of Zoom meetings and team meetings online, working on a sustainability plan.
Yeah, talk about that. About seven of us, including Cherie here, who's a map maker, and so we each have different experiences. I'm a biology environmental science teacher. My background's in environmental science, and then we also have a environmental engineer who's part of the team. And Brent, you're also an engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's see. We then we've got Karen who.
Knows a lot about green building techniques.
Definitely, yeah, yep. Works in that field. And so, anyway, with this team of folks and some other volunteers, we kind of looked at what areas do we want to focus on, and so we each took parts of that and collaborated, but then also, you know, worked individually, sent it to each other, got feedback, took lots of data from the farm, and then also looked at different different solutions around the country, around the world, what other people are doing, talked to people, sent bits and pieces to people, got feedback. And
yeah, I'll interject.
It took about 8 months, I'd say, altogether.
So we've got it complete, and we've got it to where you can download the document off of our website, which is
kcfarmschool.org.
All right.
kcfarmschool.org. And yeah, the great thing about it, in my opinion, is that it's just kind of this open thing that other people can use as a model. So we intended initially, or like all along, is to make sure that this is something that other people can see. Okay, so I could also look on my property at, you know, what is my location? What resources do I have just native to this area? And then how do I manage each of these things? You know, the water and the soil and the animals and the plants and the air and the energy and everything that comes and goes here. How can we best manage that so we harm the least and we regenerate the most?
Yeah, and I'll throw in, too, that it's pretty similar to some other bigger organizations' plans, the Climate Action KC plan, that is a similar kind of a framework. And we are very open to collaborating with other bigger groups, particularly if they could come here and sort of claim what we're doing, and we can be tallied as a bigger, you know, regional initiative, and that would give us exposure and maybe some more, you know, synergies with other groups. So we're very open to that.
Yeah, and really anybody who wants to use this for their own, you know, kind of organizations looking to do something like a sustainability plan, whether it's everything from a church, anyone who's got land, basically, and particularly those who are using the land in any way, but particularly for growing, whether it's at your house or, you know, another farm or any larger operation, you know, looking at this would be a good model for how to do things on your own.
So we've committed to making this a living document. We're going to, every time we think of a new project, we're going to go back and look at what we've written and modify what we have and kind of update it. So what are our first things that we're going to work on that off of this plan?
So I think the most pressing things have to do with water, because water is being, you know, coming on this land, and it's going off this land. And so we've done some things already here at the farm school, like there's rain gardens and there's berms and swales that capture the water and use it for plants, whether it's for pollinators or for crops. We're managing little bits and pieces at the periphery of the land, but we want to do that better. And we also have surfaces, hard surfaces, like the building itself and some gravel areas that water just either, you know, pools and goes to areas where it's less convenient and causes maybe some harm, like inside the building here that we're in. And also just gets wasted, so it's not being utilized efficiently. So that's really the next order of business, is water management, and looking at everything from, you know, water catchment off the buildings and filtering that ideally so it could be used on different kinds of crops in the most healthy way possible. And then also just diverting water into other water gardens or other areas.
Nice.
And in particular, yeah, this applies to this this new property. So where we're at right now is inside of a building that's on this 4-acre piece of land.
That's historically been called the Gibbs Road Farm.
That's right.
For 30 years.
Yeah, so this is Gibbs Road is what we refer to this. And then across the street, across 42nd Street, is what's called Common Ground. And so that's an area that was acquired just recently, last fall, by the farm school. And that has not been really modified much. There's been paths mowed into it so we can observe it, but we really have been listening to the land and observing things and talking to other people. We just had a meeting about that last Saturday, one of our quarterly roundtables where we listen to the community roundtables. So we had about 15 people there talking about their ideas and their hopes and next steps for what to do with that land. And so, among other things, we're looking at what the water resources are there on that land and how to best start off right with how to manage those. And so There's lots of different initiatives, but another big initiative right now is identifying what the plants are there so that we're not going to take away any native plants that are really helping some of the ecosystem thrive. So we don't want to alter the ecosystem more than is necessary. On 11 acres, that's so much more than we have now. So we're definitely not able to just put in row crops all over. It's very hilly. And it's also a very, very rich in terrain and rich in geology. Do you want to say anything, Cherie?
Yeah. So this entire area has mines underneath it. I don't know the entire history, but as far as I know, it's different limestone, right? Is that that's
yeah?
That's what they quarried.
Yeah, they quarried
for foundations of homes and all kinds of buildings in this area about 90 years ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. So there's maps out there. And we're going to hopefully get a geologist out here to potentially maybe drill and see what materials are down there.
I had a device that will measure the water level in a well. It's basically just a little probe, and once it touches the water, it beeps. And it was 70 feet long, and it was deeper than that. And so I modified it. Now it goes 150 feet. And so hopefully we can go over there and repeat the test and get an accurate measurement of what the top of the water in the chamber below is at.
Yeah.
And that mine is a great, great resource potential for a few reasons. For one thing, it's that land hasn't been developed partially because there's that mine underneath, and so it also has this water that's available through this pipe and through other potential places we could try to access it. And that's water that's, you know, always about 50 degrees. There's air that's down there that's always about 50 degrees, and so those resources of the warm air and but also cool air and the water could be utilized on the land.
If that cool vit pipe was in our hoop house that we're working on this weekend that needs the new plastic film, then you could potentially put an electric blower motor, you know, and a fan to suck that air up year round. It would cool in the summertime and heat in the wintertime. That'd be really neat. So
we're
thinking about what the possibilities are. We're also going to test that water and make sure that it's, you know, clean enough and not polluted so that we could use it to grow, to water our vegetables and things as well. So.
Yeah. And you mentioned the warmth in the summertime. I thought one other thing that we were thinking about over there, just since the summers, you know, are prone to getting hot here, the idea that, you know, the land gets overheated, and that has caused a lot of bolting or, you know, crops coming on too early. It's hard to get germination at the right time and, you know, getting plants started. And
Lydia mentioned that. Yep.
Yeah. So we are thinking about ways to keep the land cooler. One of those suggestions has been using mirrors to basically catch that light as it comes in and reflect it back rather than having it get absorbed by the land and then, you know, radiate heat onto the surface so that the soil itself, so soil temperature stays cooler. So we're thinking about doing some experiments with this MEERS program, this MEERS for Earth's Energy Rebalancing, in order to be a part of this solution of keeping the air cooler, but also keeping our land, our soil itself cooler with the use of mirrors.
So I'll remind listeners that we also have a webpage. You can search Eco Radio KC, and it takes you right to our page. All of our past episodes are available as an audio file that you can listen to.
Even the ones I used to do.
Even the ones that Dave did. So I did a show on the mirror idea. With maybe a year ago with the guy that thought the idea up, an MIT, brilliant guy from MIT named Ye Tao. So if you're interested in that, go listen to that.
Yeah, it's a really novel, revolutionary idea I think we're going to see more of, kind of related to agrivoltaics, where we have, you know, in farm settings, you've got mirrors, solar panels that are going to absorb the light as it comes down and shade your plants.
Yeah, they say that's a
microclimate.
You can, and they say that the agrivoltaics, where you're using a PV panel, you know, in some sort of a cover over that you can walk under and grow vegetables, so that there's partial light. That it's actually It makes it cooler. The PV panels provide more electricity when they're cooler. It helps with water retention, so you don't have to water as much. So it seems like a really interesting idea. Mm-hmm. Okay, I think I'm going to pause now, and then we're going to go over and drop a rock down that and see what it sounds like.
We'll be back.
Okay, so we just used this gizmo that tests how deep it is to the water, and we ascertained that it is how far, Cherie?
115 feet.
115 feet down to the water.
And then the well itself, the water is at least another 35 feet, maybe 45 feet.
Yeah, we've
till
it hits the bottom.
Yeah,
of the...
we've stuck a string down with a weight on it, 160 feet so far, and we haven't hit the bottom. So there's quite a bit of water down there that we could potentially use.
Yeah, so the
pretty
farm
fun.
Could really benefit from all that.
All right.
Moisture.
Well, thanks for playing with me, guys. That was fun.
Thanks for having us.
All right. Okay, I'm talking with Alicia Ellingsworth, my final interviewee from the farm, last but not least. As I told you, we've pretty much covered everything, but wrap it up. Tell us about this last few days and how much love the community has shown the farm.
Britt, that's exactly how to describe it, right? So these last few days, these last few years, the experiences that we've had is when there's a need, community show up. And community means you. It means Dave and Cherie. It means Dawn and... It means the Let's Grow Wind Up people and the Ag Explorer families and the people who come to market and the market vendors. People show up and do what they can. So our Pay What You're Able model is more than a way to get some vegetables at a price that you can afford. When we say pay what you're able, we mean that from our cores. And we believe that if we all show up and share what we have, then we all have what we need. So, for example, with the greenhouse roof, someone showed up with soup to feed the people. Many people showed up to take off the old sea channel, to pull down the roof, to clean up all the things that blew around. And one person reached out on Thursday afternoon, and she said, "I had no idea. I just saw the post. I'll be there tomorrow." And I knew what she meant. She knew why she was coming. She was coming to bring a check. And she came. She wanted to hear the story. We told the story of the greenhouse and how we've been working to bring it up to 21st century standards. And she's been there along with us. And she knows that what she's able to do is share money. Just like you are able to share this opportunity to be on Eco Radio. Just like Dave brings his students. Just like Cherie brings her mapping skills. So when we talk about pay while you're able, we mean that. Pay, share what you're able, and that guarantees. I mean, we have 3 years proof now that that works. I always want to make sure that you don't misunderstand. We are not this rich nonprofit sitting on a hill here in Wyandotte County blowing money around. We are skin of our teeth every single pay period. We don't intend to be that way for much longer. I mean, we need to grow and expand, but we have had what we needed. We have always paid people. We have always kept the lights on. We always have seed. We always have enough to share. We feed people around this table anytime they come. There's always enough, and we share it.
Well, that's awesome.
I get kind of preachy.
No, it's beautiful. So this episode will air on Monday night, the night before the solstice day, the shortest day of the year, where we celebrate the return of the light, as I think you're fond to remember.
Yeah. Solstice is special, isn't it?
It is. All right. Well, I think you're bringing a lot of light to this part of the world, so good on you.
You're very sweet, Brent. Together we're doing it.
Together we're doing it. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you. We can make tomorrow better than today.
Yep.
You just heard selections from Brent Ragsdale on Eco Radio KC, Community Radio Kansas City, as broadcast December 20, 2021. Thank you to Brent and the team at KKFI. Next week, we go back to the place where Earth is tipping most rapidly, into a new climate and a new landscape, the Arctic, Twyla Moon at the National Snow and Ice Data Center is one of our guests. We will also explore winter heat waves. Be sure to tune in for our opening show of 2022. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.